Welcome to Creative Edge Writers Showcase. I'm your host, Christy Stratus, author of Anatomy of a Darkened Heart and Brotherhood of Secrets, and I am the owner of my editing company at proofpositivepro.com. This show is part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and our guest today is Peter James, a man who really needs no introduction, but he is a best-selling, multi-award-winning author, primarily crime and thriller, but other things as well, and he has sold 19 million copies of his books, and he's also an executive producer for several films. So thank you so much for being here, Peter.
Well, it's great to be here, Christy.
I have to congratulate you because you recently, I think it was last month, had your latest release called Absolute Proof, and I wanted to ask you what it's all about.
Right. Absolute Proof is, in a nutshell, is a very twisty thriller which is centered around the theme of and very much in, it sort of follows in the vein of a book like The Da Vinci Code in terms of kind of big canvas international thriller. And it centers around the topic of what would happen if somebody credible claimed to have absolute proof of God's existence. And the origin for the book was way back in 1989 when I got a phone call out of the blue from an elderly guy saying, "Is that Peter James, the author?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Thank God I found you. It's taken me 2 weeks." And I phoned every Peter James in the phone book in England. And I was one of those moments you think, do you hang up or not? But he sounded a pleasant guy. And he said, "Look, I'm not a nutcase. I was a bomber pilot in the war. I'm a recently retired academic. I have been given absolute proof of God's existence, and I've been told you're the man to help me get taken seriously." And that was the starting point.
Wow, that's really amazing. And like you said, of course, your first instinct would be, should I hang up the phone? But now, all these years later, you were able to write a book about it.
Yes, he said to me, "I need to come and see you, Mr. James. I'm going to need 4 days of your time." I said, "Excuse me." I said, 4 days is a pretty big ask. I said, "You know, I give you half an hour, and if we need more time, we could take it from there." And I said, "But before we do anything, tell me a bit more, please." And he said, "Yes." He said, "My wife was also an academic. She recently died of cancer. And before she died, we made an agreement that I would go to a medium and try and communicate with her. So a few months after she passed, I did this. And instead of my wife coming through, a male came through who said he was a representative of God and that God was extremely concerned about the state of the world. I felt that if mankind could have faith in God reaffirmed, it would get the world back on an even keel. And as proof of his bona fides, he gave me three pieces of information that he said nobody on earth knows. And he said, the author, Peter James, is the man who helped you get taken seriously." That was like the starting point. Anyhow, long story short, I met with a guy, and he was a nice guy. He was in his mid-70s. A lot of people said to me, "Why on earth did you meet him?" And I say, look, everybody you ever meet in life has a story. Not always one that's going to make a great book, but I think everyone has something that's worth listening to. That's why I met him. And he basically sat him down, got him a cup of tea, and he opened his attaché case, and he took out this manuscript, which was 1,000 pages long. And he said, "We start with you reading this." And I said, "Fine, leave it with me." He said, no, this was channeled to me by God. I can't let this out of my sight." I think, I said, "Mr. Nixon," his name was Harry Nixon. I said, "This will take me 4 days to read." He said, "I told you I needed 4 days of your time." I said, "So you're going to sit there for 4 days while I sit here?" I said, "That's not going to happen, okay?" And I said, "Before we go any further, do you want to tell me these three pieces of information?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I have been given these three pieces of information that nobody on earth knows. I've been given the location of the tomb of Akhenaten, which was Joseph Tutankhamun's uncle, who was the first monotheist pharaoh. I've been given the location of the Holy Grail and the location of the Ark of the Covenant. I have the compass coordinates for all of these three." And I said, "And have you looked for any of them?" He said, "Yes. I was a pilot in the war. I can navigate. The compass coordinates for the Holy Grail or a place called Chalice Well in Glastonbury in Somerset in the West Country of England." Now, I'd never heard of Chalice Well at this point. I subsequently found out Chaloswell is a holy site on the edge of the town of Glastonbury, where Joseph of Arimathea was rumored to have bought the Holy Grail after the crucifixion and concealed it. And he said, I have been dowsing and metal detecting on the exact spot, the coordinates I've been given, and there's something under the ground. It's run by a group of trustees. I've approached them to do an archaeological dig, and they won't take me seriously. But Mr. James, I think they would take you seriously. So he finally trundles off, and I start to read the manuscript. And as you can imagine, I get about 20 pages in and begin losing the will to live. It's just tracts from the Bible. It's random annotations. But by sheer chance, the next day, I had to go to Bristol, which is not that far from Charleswell, to do a BBC radio interview for a book I was then promoting. And I was finished the interview, and I was just chatting to the presenter, and suddenly, out of the blue, she mentions Charleswell. And a kind of shiver went through me. I thought, I've never heard of Charleswell, and I'm reading it twice in 2 days. And I've always believed in coincidence being more than something than just coincidence. I said, what do you know about Charleswell? She said, oh, my uncle's a trustee. So I left her, I told her the story, and I left really freaked. And I went and I phoned a friend of mine who at that time was the Bishop of Reading. And I said, I have to come and see you. And I met up with him 2 days later, and I told him the story. And I said, what? And his name was Dominic Walker. I said, what do you think, Dominic? He said, well, firstly, proof is the enemy of faith. Secondly, I would want more than three sets of compass coordinates to have proof of God. And I said, what would you want? He said, I would want something that defies the laws of physics in the universe. I'd want a pretty impressive miracle. And I said, if somebody could deliver that, what then? He said, well, I really think they'd be murdered, because whose God is it going to be? You'd have every different faction, Anglican, Catholic, Judaic, Islamic, Sikhs, claiming ownership. And you'd have a communist country like China not wanting a higher power, usurping its authority. And I thought at that moment, yes, I have the makings of a great book here. And that was the starting point.
That's amazing. That's an incredible story. And like you said, there's no way that could all be coincidence. So, man, that's amazing. Have you been in touch with this person since you published the book?
Well, it was a really good question. When I finished the book, and I finished the first draft of it in October 16, and then it's much last year revising it, we tried to see if he was still alive. Because I did have communications from about 10 years afterwards, and then they stopped. And my assistant, Linda, managed to find out that he'd died 6 years previously. But she tracked, very smart, she did some detective work, and she tracked down the real estate agent that sold his house after he died, the executor sale, and said to them, look, if there's any relative alive who'd like to speak to Peter James, here's our number. And I got a phone call about 2 weeks later from his grandson, who's a doctor in Cambridge, a guy called James Connor, who was absolutely thrilled to bits. And he and his brother and his sister, who's a lawyer, came down and had tea with my wife, Laura, and I in December of last year, just after Christmas. And he said, you know, Granddad was not a flake. He wasn't even religious, but he genuinely believed that he'd been charged with this mission of trying to prove to the world that God really did exist. And he said he was, we met a number of his air crew who flew in with him in the war. And they said he was the guy you'd want in the plane with you when you were in a crisis. They said he was a real steady pair of hands, not remotely a nutter. And so that was really interesting. And they're absolutely delighted, because they knew that grandfather was desperate to get the message, the book written. I mean, obviously, this absolute proof is not a polemic to say God exists, but it's, you know, it's a thriller. But, you know, but I took that as the kind of starting point. And I've examined, part of the reason it took me 28 years was I wanted to, A, understand all the world's kind of key religions and make sure I didn't offend any in the writing of the book. And secondly, I had to come up with an ending that even the hard, that I had to come up with that that miracle that even a hardcore atheist would have problems dismissing. I had to find something for the climax that was as big as the sun rising from the west instead of the east one day.
I'm sure that if he was around, he would be so thrilled that this book is out there. And it sounds amazing. Hugh Bonneville is the person who read the audiobook. And of course, he's wonderful. I did listen to a little bit of it. And he's really, I'm sure he brings it to life beautifully. So I know that this book is a little bit different for you. And I wondered if this might be your new favorite book that you've written, or if there's another book that's a favorite of yours that you've written.
No, I think that the two favorite books I've written are Dead Simple, which was the first Roy Grace novel, which is the book that kind of set off the series that I guess made my name really as an author more than anything else that I've written the Roy Grace series. But Absolute Proof, I definitely shares the laurels. It's a book, I love the book. I love the fact, I always love when I write to try to not preach anything, but I love to inform my readers as well. You know, I like to write the kind of books that I like to read. And when I love reading a book, I love reading thrillers, but I love reading a book that's not only given me a great ride, but in which I've learned something about the world in which we live, about human nature, about why people do what they do. And Absolute Proof, of course, it gave me the great opportunity to examine what being religious means, what being an atheist means, and to also kind of just, I think, you know, we tend to all live in certain bubbles of whatever we believe or we don't believe, you know, whether we're agnostics or atheists or passionate Christians or Jews or whatever, without really ever knowing much about other religions. So I've tried in the book to give a kind of a real balanced view of what some of the other religions also are about. But again, all the time emphasizing that it is a thriller, it's not a textbook on religion.
That's a tricky balance, but I'm sure that once you put it all together and you do the balancing act properly, I'm sure it comes out really both fascinating and exciting.
Hugh Bonneville was the great choice as well, because he studied theology at university.
Oh, that's perfect. That's amazing. Cool. Even better. So many coincidences actually coming together for that book. You mentioned Detective Superintendent Roy Grace, and I know that he's a much loved character of yours, as you said. And so I wondered what you think makes him so appealing to readers.
I always say it in jest, but I say that if I was ever unlucky enough to have a member of my family murdered, he's the detective I would want on the case doing the investigation. I think it's a combination. I think people like, I've always made him very human, and I've had one of the things that I learned early on in my research with the police was that good homicide detectives are quite different to how we so often see them portrayed on television. And that they tend to be very empathetic people who become really passionately involved with the victim's family and loved ones. And it almost becomes personal to them. And I've had the added luck of, I started going out with the police way back in the early 1980s. I wrote my first novel, which was a very bad spy thriller. And the second one, which was even worse. And I just got married at that time. We got burgled, and a young detective came to take fingerprints, and he saw the two books, and he said, if you ever want research help with the police, give me a call. And he was a guy called Mike Harris, and he was married to a detective. And they invited my then wife and I to a barbecue at the house, and all their friends were cops. They're everything from kind of homicide detectives, response, traffic, police divers, child protection team. And I just found these people fascinating. And I realized that, you know, I was right at the start of my kind of writing career. And I thought, you know, for an author, and I wanted to write thrillers, but I also knew I wanted to write about people, about human nature. And I just began to realize that nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a cop. They see everything, from an infant death to an elderly couple swindled out of their life savings to a brutal murder. And that was the start of my interest. And I was introduced one day to a young detective inspector called Dave Gaylor. And I always remember going in his office in Brighton Police Station. And I've never seen an office that was such a mess. Every inch of the floor was covered in blue and green plastic crates bulging with folders. And there was this little sort of balding dome at the back of the room. And I said, "I'm sorry, are you moving?" He said, "No, these are my dead friends." I looked at him and thought, "Great, I've met the only weirdo in Sussex CID." And he laughed and he said, "I'm a homicide detective, but I've also been tasked with reopening all the unsolved murders in Sussex, where there is still someone alive who could benefit from the investigation, and applying the latest advances in DNA technology and fingerprint technology to see if we can move them forward. That each one of these crates is the principal case file of an unsolved murder. I am the last chance each victim has for justice and that their family have for closure." And I love that human image about him.
That's an amazing thing that happened. I've never really read or heard anything like that before, so I could see where that would really inspire you and bring a character to life for you. How incredible.
Yeah, he said to me, "What are you writing at the moment?" And I was writing a psychological thriller at that time called Denial. And he said, "Tell me about it." So I started telling him. He said, "Hang on a sec. Your character wouldn't have done that. And why has your detective not got an outside inquiry team doing this? And I don't think your character would have done that under those circumstances." And I realized this guy had a really creative side to him. And it's something I did learn, I've learned subsequently about what makes a good homicide detective. It's a long answer to your question about why people like Roy Grace, but I think Roy is a classic example of a good homicide detective. And what Dave Gaylor had was almost a split personality, in that one side of Dave is completely anal. Because every homicide, every major crime is a huge puzzle of hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces you have to put together painstakingly. But often they're solved by clear blue sky creative thinking. And Dave Gaylor had both those sides in spades. And we became friends. And over the next few years, he rose to become Detective Chief Superintendent, Head of Major Crime for Sussex. And in 2002, my publishers, Pam McMillan, asked if I'd ever thought of creating a detective as a central character. So I went to Dave and I said, "Would you like to be a fictional cop?" And he loved it. And he is my real life Roy Grace. We have a ritual. I mean, we're now really close mates. When I got married again in 2015, he was best man at the wedding. But we have a ritual. Every time I start a new Roy Grace novel, we sit down at the same table in this local pub with a new Moleskine notebook. We plan the plot. I then go off and I write the first 100 pages. He then reads them and tells me how Roy Grace and the other police characters would think and act as real police officers. And that helps to give me that kind of authenticity that's, for me, is so important.
Absolutely, that makes him extremely believable. It's a perfect relationship, really. I couldn't think of anything better.
I always joke, I say some people travel with their private detectives, and I travel with my private detective chief superintendent.
I love that. I saw that on your Facebook, I believe it was in October, you had said that you were writing the last chapters of the 15th Roy Grace book. Do you have any idea how many we can look forward to?
I just love writing them. I don't have any plans to kill Roy off. And what I did was that quite a lot of crime writers I know have kind of aged their character a year with each book. And when I created Roy, I decided I didn't want to do that because he just was in the process. We learn when we first meet Roy in Dead Simple that 9 years earlier, his wife Sandy went vanished off the face of the earth, and he spent 9 years looking for her. Doesn't know whether she ran off with a lover, got murdered, had an accident, got kidnapped. And he's found it really hard to move forward. And then when we first, Dead Simple, he's just at the very beginning of a new relationship with Cleo Morey, who runs the mortuary. And I wanted to show this love affair developing. And you can't do that if you jump a book a year, because a year in a new relationship is a long time. So I played with time with the books in the sense that although each book takes place a year later, culturally. So I move it forward in our time, so that this 15th book is set in 2017. I've only moved the books forward in real time, a few days, a few weeks with each book. So when we first meet Roy, he was coming up to 39. 15 books later, he's only 42. So he's got another good sort of 24 years in his police career left to go yet. So I have no plans to kill him off. I'm still at a point where I love writing him and all the other characters with him. When I sit down to write, I always think, "Hi Roy, how are you doing? Hi Norman Potting, who have you offended this week?"
Well, that's a relief to hear that we can look forward to more. And I think that will be very hard for people to get used to when the time comes that maybe he won't be around anymore. So it's great to know we have a lot more to look forward to. And I do know that a lot of times in crime and mystery, people, readers, love sticking with one detective that they can get used to. And as you said, playing with time becomes important because people don't want them to age as fast as they normally would. They want to stick with them through their whole lives, and they just want them to stay around, you know? So it's great to know that you're doing that.
Yeah, I had a fan letter which made me smile a couple of years back, saying, "Dear Mr. James, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but Roy Grace is the only detective I've ever wanted to sleep with." Think that's a great compliment.
That is. That should be a quote on your website. I also wanted to delve a little bit into your stage plays. I think it's really amazing that you write stage plays, and they are, as far as I have seen, maybe there's multiple genres, but I know you have one coming up in 2019, I believe, and that is The House on Cold Hill, which seems to be more horror oriented. And I know that since you are best known for crime and thriller, do you find it kind of along the same lines to write horror, or is it like a totally different mindset for you? And it's a stage play, so that's also different.
Yeah, it's a different mindset. I mean, The House on Cold Hill I wrote as a novel originally, which I lived in a seriously haunted house for 10 years, and that gave me the idea for the book. I wanted to write like a modern ghost story. And the book came out about 4 years ago. I've actually got a sequel called The Secret of Cold Hill. It's going to be published in October next year. So that'll follow Absolute Proof. And it's been I've had two Roy Grace novels and also my novella The Perfect Murder adapted for the stage, and I kind of work the actual play itself is written by Sean McKenna, but I work really closely with him both on the scripting and the whole kind of production play. And I love seeing my work on the stage, because you can't I love sitting at the back of the theater and watching the audiences. You can't sit and watch somebody reading a book. It's a bit weird to do that. But it's fantastic to watch. I've learned so much actually from comments of the audience, because in Dead Simple, there is a beautiful woman who turns out to be an absolute monster. And there's a reveal moment in it. And every time I'm sitting in the theater and that reveal happens, the audience just you can feel a gasp of pleasure. And I thought, people like beautiful, evil women. There's something really kind of that gets people, both male and females. And that sort of then gave me an idea for another book with a monstrous female lead character. And also, what's quite I love about live theater is it's dangerous. Things can go wrong. Again, in Dead Simple, the novel starts with a terrible car crash. They buried this guy alive in a coffin for his bachelor party to pay him back for all the pranks he's played on his other friends. And their idea is that they drive him out to woods, they put him in a coffin in remote woodlands, in a grave they've dug the day before, and they're going to leave him there for 2 hours. He's got a bottle of whiskey and a magazine, but they're going to leave him there for 2 hours and then come back and dig him up. And they all get wiped out in a car wreck. And there's this moment where, and it was staged incredibly. They had a van in the woods and headlights coming towards the audience. And then this sort of scream, and then this almighty bang, and the whole theater just goes dark. They even turn off the emergency lights for about 10 seconds. And then you hear his voice. It was played by Jamie Lomas, and you hear his voice cry out, because he's got a walkie-talkie. He goes, "Where am I?" And we were in the theater in Woking in Surrey one week of the tour. And this bloke in the audience shouts out, "You're in Woking, mate."
That's the audience reaction. You can't get watching. Yeah, somebody read a book. That's too funny.
And another thing, I had Les Dennis was playing this character who's having an affair with this kind of hooker he's met in the massage parlor. And he's sitting there right at the beginning of the play, and he says, "You know, my wife doesn't understand me." And somebody in the audience shouts out, "Neither does mine, mate."
Oh, these are hilarious. It must be really rewarding to hear these reactions, because it really means people are engaged and having a great time.
Just love it. Yeah.
And I just want to ask one more question then. You have won many, many awards. There's a list on your website if anyone would like to go take a look at that. But they start back in 1967 and they're all the way up to this year, 2018. And I wondered if there was any award that you've won that really stands out to you as meaning the most.
That's a nice question. Thank you. I guess two of the ones, the one was the Crime Writers Association Diamond Dagger, because that's voted for by fellow crime writers. And I think, you know, to have there, it was it was an award I when I first started writing, was just a dream and never thought it'd be possible to win it. It was a great moment that your own fellow peers vote for it. And the other was the W.H. Smith Award I got, which was voted for by the public. And again, that, you know, where I think often with awards, and they're voted by small panels, and I've been on panels myself, and I know how difficult it is judging, but when it's actually voted by the public, it kind of speaks from the heart.
Absolutely. I can see how those would mean so much. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Peter. This has been a wonderful conversation. And can you tell everyone, our listeners, where they can find you on social media and your website, please?
Yeah, sure. My website is easy. It's peterjames.com. And actually all the links to social media come off that. So I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and I have a YouTube channel, which for any budding author, I think would be of interest, because I have a section on that. It's free. You just click on it. It's peterjames.com / YouTube. But you can jump to the link from my website. And we have a section on that called the Author Studio. I've interviewed about 150 authors, like very short interviews, like 3, 4, 5 minutes. I've got authors like Lee Child, George R. R. Martin, Kathy Reichs, Ian Rankin, Peter Robinson, dozens of authors. And I've asked them roughly the same 10 questions, like where do you get your ideas from? How do you write? And I've done it as a resource for people to learn from. And so it's worth jumping on that. And if you subscribe, you just get updated over time. There's a new post every week on that.
That's fabulous. And they are relatively short too. So it's actually addictive going through them. I have watched some of them already. So thank you so much for joining us on the Creative Edge Writers Showcase. This has been a copyrighted podcast owned by the Authors on the Air, Global Radio Network, and Creative Edge Marketing. And we're going to be back December 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern with Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim, the author of 8 books and 10 plays. And in the meantime, you can look up our show on Facebook for updates, and we will see you in the next episode.